Dove says that at Fry's own request, she's not allowed to tell anyone which sushi Fry's going out for, including us. I feel a little funny about that, until we get the first drone. It's riding an in-out skeet, which can slip through a jelly double wall without causing a blowout. Jove Op uses them to deliver messages they consider sensitive, whatever that means. And that's what we thought it was at first. Then it lights up, and we're looking at this image of a two-stepper dressed for broadcast. He's asking one question after another on a canned loop. In a panel on his right, instructions on how to record, pause, and playback are scrolling on repeat. The jelly asks if we want to get rid of it. We toss the whole thing in the waste chute, skeet and all, and the jelly poops it out as a little ball of scrap to become some scavenger's lucky find. Later, Dubonnet files a report with Jove Op about the unauthorized intrusion. Jove Op gives him a receipt, but no other response. We're all expecting a reprimand for failing to detect the skeet's rider before it got through. Doesn't happen.
"Somebody's drunk," Bait says.
"Query it."
"No, don't," says Splat. "By the time they're sober, they'll have to cover it up or their job's down the chute. It never happened. Everything's 8x8.
"Until someone checks our records," Dubonnet says,
and tells the jelly to query, who assures him that's a wise thing to do. The jelly has been doing this sort of thing more often lately, making little comments. Personally, I like those little touches. Splat, however, looks annoyed.
"I was joking," he says, enunciating carefully.
They can't touch you for joking, no matter how tasteless, but it has to be clear. We laugh, just to be on the safe side, except for Aunt Chovy, who says she doesn't think it was very funny because she can't laugh unless she really feels it. Some people are like that. Dubonnet gets an answer within a few minutes. It's a form message in legalese, but this just is. "We heard you for the first time. Go now and sin no more."
"They all can't be drunk," Fred says. "Can they?"
"Can't they?" says Sheerluck. "You guys have crewed with me long enough to know how fortune smiles on me and mine." "Spoken like a member of the Church of the Four-Leaf Horseshoe," Glynnis says. Fred perks right up.
"Is that new casino on Europa?" he asks.
Fred loves casinos. Not gambling, just casinos. The jelly offers to look it up for him.
"Synchronicity is a real thing. It's got math," Sheerluck is saying. Her color's starting to get a little bright. So is Glynnis's.
I'd rather they don't give each other ruby red hell while we're all still in the jelly.
"And the dictionary definition of serendipity is, chance favors the prepared mind."
"I'm prepared to go home and log out. Who's prepared to join me?"
Dubonnet says before Glynnis can sneer openly. I like Glynnis, vinegar and all, but sometimes I think she should have been a crab instead of an octopus. Our private quarters are supposed to have no surveillance except for the standard safety monitoring. Yeah, we don't believe that for a nanosecond. But if Jove Op ever got caught in the act, the unions would eat them alive and poop out the bones to fertilize Europa's germ farms. So either they're even better at it than any of us can imagine, or they're taking a calculated risk. Most sushi claim to believe the former. I'm in the latter camp. I mean, they watch us so much already, they've gotta want to look at something else for a change. We share the typical octo crew quarters. 8 rooms around a large common area. When Fry was with us, we curtained off part of it for her, but somehow she was always spilling out of it. Her stuff, I mean. We'd find underwear bobbing around in the lavabo, shoes orbiting a lamp, good thing she only needed 2, live paper flapping around the room in the air currents.
all the time she'd spent out here, and she still couldn't get the hang of housekeeping in zero-G. It's the sort of thing that stops being cute pretty quickly when you've got full occupancy, plus one. I could tell she was trying, but eventually we had to face the truth. Much as we loved her, our resident girl thing was a slob. I thought that was going to be a problem, but she wasn't even gone a day before it felt like there was something missing. I'd look around expecting to see some item of clothing or jewelry cruising past. The latest escapee from one of her not terribly secure reticules.
So, who wants to bet that Fry goes Octo? Splat says when we got home.
Who'd want to bet she doesn't? Replies Sheerluck.
Not me, says Glynnis. So sour I can feel it in my crop.
I'm thinking she's going to start again with the crab act. Pinch, pinch, pinch. But she doesn't. Instead, she air swims down to the grotto, sticks to the wall with two arms, and folds the rest up so she's completely hidden. She misses our girl thing and doesn't want to talk at the moment, but she also doesn't want to be completely alone either. It's an Octo thing. Sometimes we want to be alone, but not necessarily by ourselves. Sheerluck joins me at the fridge and asks,
What do you think, Octo?
I don't know, I say, and I honestly don't. It never occurred to me to wonder, but I'm not sure if that's because I took it for granted she would. I grab a bag of kribble. Anchovy notices and gives me those big serious eyes.
You can't just live on crunchy krill, RK.
I've got a craving, I tell her.
Me too, says Bait.
He tries to reach around from behind me, and I knot him.
Message from Dove, says Dubonnet,
just before we start wrestling, and puts it on the big screen. There's not actually much about Fry, except that she's coming along nicely with another deck to go before she's done. Although it's not clear to any of us whether that means Fry'll be all done and good to go, or if Dove's just referring to the surgery. Then we get distracted with all the rest of the stuff in the message. It was full of clips from the dirt, two-steppers talking about Fry like they all knew her, and what it was like out here, and what going out for sushi meant. Some two-steppers didn't seem to care much, but some of them were stark-spinning bugfuck. I mean, it's been a great big while since I was a biped, and we live so long out here that we tend to morph along with the times. The two-stepper I was couldn't get a handle on me as I am now. But then neither could the Octo I was when I finished rehab and met my first crew. I didn't choose Octo. Back then, surgery wasn't as advanced, and nanoretics weren't as commonplace or as programmable. So you got whatever the doctors thought gave you the best chance of a life worth living. I wasn't too happy at first, but it's hard to be unhappy in a place this beautiful, especially when you feel so good physically all the time. It was somewhere between 3 and 4 J years after I turned that people could finally choose what kind of sushi they went out for. But I got no regrets. Anymore. I've got it smooth all over. Only I don't feel too smooth listening to two-steppers chewing the air over things they don't know anything about and puking up words like abominations, atrocities, and subhuman monsters. One news program even runs clips from the most recent remake of the goddamn island of fucking Dr. Moreau. Like that's Holy Writ or something. I can't stand more than a few minutes before I take my kribble into my bolt hole, close the hatch, and hit soundproof. A little while later, Glynnis beeps.
You know how way back in the extreme dead past, people in the dirt thought everything in the universe revolved around them?
She pauses, but I don't answer.
Then the scope of human knowledge expanded, and we all know that was wrong.
So? I grunt.
Not everybody got the memo, she says.
She waits for me to say something. Come on, RK. Are they going to see OKK Hightower?
I'd like to give them a ride on it, I say.
None of them are going to come out here with us abominations. They're all going to cuddle up with each other in the dirt and drown in each other's shit until they all do the one thing they were pooped into this universe to do, which is become extinct.
I open the door. You're really baiting them, you know that?
Baiting who? There's nobody listening. Nobody here except us sushi, she says, managing to sound sour and utterly innocent both at the same time.
Only Glennis.
I message Dove to say we'll be down under for at least 2 J-days, on loan to Outercom. Population in the outer part of the system, especially around Saturn, has doubled in the last couple of J-years, and will probably double again in less time. The civil communication network runs below the plane of the solar disk, and it's completely dedicated. No governments, no military, just small business, entertainment, and social interaction. Well, so far it's completely dedicated, but nobody's in any position for a power grab yet. Outercom is an ice giant's operation, and originally it served only the Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune systems. No one seems to know exactly where the home office is. For example, which moon? I figure even if they started off as far out as Uranus, they've probably been on Titan since they decided to expand to Jupiter. Anyway, their technology is crazy great. It still takes something over 40 minutes for Hello to get from Big J to Saturn, and another 40 till you hear, "Who the hell is this?" But you get less noise than a local call on Jovop. Jovop wasn't too happy when the entertainment services started migrating to Outercom, and things got kind of tense. Then they cut a deal. Outercom got all the entertainment and stayed out of the education business, at least in the Jovian system. So everything's fine, and Jovop loans them anything they need, like a big old friendly neighbor. But there's still plenty of potential for trouble. Of all kinds. The Jovian system is the divide between the inner planets and the outer. We've had governments that try to align with the Innies and others that courted the Outies. The current government wants the Big J officially designated as an outer world, not just an ally. Saturn's been fighting it, claiming that Big J wants to take over and build an empire. Which is pretty much what Mars and Earth said when the last government was trying to get inner status. Earth was a little more colorful about it. There were two-steppers hollering that it was all a plot by monsters and abominations. For example, us, to get our unholy limbs on fresh meat for our unholy appetites. If Big J got inner planet status, they said, people would be rounded up in the streets and shipped out to be changed into unnatural, subhuman creatures with no will of their own. Except for the most beautiful women, who would be kept as is and chained in brothels where, well, you get the idea. That alone would be enough to make me vote Audi, except the Big J is really neither Audi nor any. The way I see it, there's inner, there's outer, and there's us. Which doesn't fit the way two-steppers do things, because it's not binary. This was all sort of bubbling away at the back of my mind while we worked on the comm station, but in an idle sort of way. I was also thinking about Fry, wondering how she was doing and what shape she'd be in the next time I saw her. I wondered if I'd recognize her. Now, that sounds kind of silly, I guess because you don't recognize someone that, for all intents and purposes, you've never seen before. But it's that spiritual thing. I had this idea that if I swam into a room full of sushi, all kinds of sushi, and Fry was there, I would know. And if I gave it a little time, I'd find her without anyone having to point her out. No question, I loved Fry the two-stepper. Now that she was sushi, I wondered if I'd be in love with her. I couldn't decide whether I liked that idea or not. Normally, I keep things simple. Sex, and only with people I like. It keeps everything pretty smooth. But in love complicates everything. You start thinking about partnership and family. And that's not so smooth because we don't reproduce. We've got new sushi and fresh sushi, but no sushi kids. We're still working on surviving out here, but it won't always be that way. I could live long enough to see that. Hell, there are still a few OG around, although I've never met them. They're all out in the ice giants. We're home half a deck before the first OKK Hightower impact, which sounds like plenty of time, but it's close enough to make me nervous. Distances out here aren't safe, even in the best top-of-the-line Jovop can. I hate being in a can anyway. If anyone ever develops a jelly for long-distance travel, I'll be their best friend forever. But even in the can, we had to hit three oases going and coming to refuel. Filing a flight plan guaranteed us a berth at each one, but only if we were on time. And there's all kinds of shit that could make us late. If a berth was available, we'd still get it. But if there wasn't, we'd have to wait and hope we didn't run out of stuff to breathe. Bate worked the plan out far enough ahead to give us generous ETA windows. But you know how it is. Just when you need everything to work the way it's supposed to, anything that hasn't gone wrong lately suddenly decides to make up for lost time. I was nervous all the way out, all through the job, all the way back. The last night on the way back, I dreamed that just as we were about to re-enter Jovop space, Io exploded and took out everything in half a radian. While we were trying to figure out what to do, something knocked us into a bad spiral that was gonna end dead center in Big Pink. I woke up with Anchovy and Splat peeling me off the wall. So embarrassing. After that, all I wanted to do was go home, slip into a jelly, and watch OKK Hightower meet Big J. By this time, the comet's actually in pieces. The local networks are all comet news all the time, like there's nothing else in the solar system, or even the universe for that matter. The experts are saying it's following the same path as the old Shoemaker Levy, and there's a lot of chatter about what that means. There are those who don't think it's a coincidence and OKK Hightower is actually some kind of message from an intelligence out in the Oort cloud or even beyond. And instead of letting it crash into Big J, we ought to try catching it, or at least parts of it. Yeah, that could happen. Jovop put out a blanket no-fly. Jellies only, no cans. Sheer luck suggests Jovop's got a secret mission to grab some fragments, but that's ridiculous. I mean, aside from the fact that any can capable of doing that would be plainly visible, the comet's been sailing around in pieces for over half a dozen square decks. There were easier places in the trajectory to get a piece, but all the experts agreed the scans showed nothing in it worth the fortune it would cost to mount that kind of mission. Funny how so many people forget about that. Suddenly, they're all shoulda, woulda, coulda, like non-buyer's remorse. But don't get me started on politics. I leave a message for Dove, saying we're back and getting ready to watch the show. What comes back is an auto-reply saying she's out of the office, reply soonest. Maybe she's busy with Fry, who probably has comet fever like everyone else. But maybe even more so, since this will be like the big moment that kicks off her new life. If she's not out of the hospital, I hope they've got a screen worthy of the event. We all want to see with our naked eyes. Well, our naked eyes and telescopes. Glennis is bringing a screen for anyone who wants a really close-up look. Considering the whole thing's gonna last about an hour, start to finish. Maybe that's not such a bad idea. It could save us some eye strain. When the first fragment hits, I find myself thinking about the sensors that fell into the atmosphere. They've got to be long gone by now, and even if they're not, there's no way we could pick up any data. It would all be just noise. Halfway through the impacts, the government overrides all the communication for a recorded, no-reply announcement. Martial law's been declared. Everybody go home. Anyone who doesn't is dust. This means we miss the last few hits, which pisses us off even though we all agree it's not a sight worth dying for. But when we get home and can't even get an instant replay, we start wondering. Then we start ranting. The government's gonna have a lot of explaining to do. And the next election ain't gonna be a love fest. And when did Jove Op turn into a government lackey? There's nothing on the news, and I mean nothing. It's all reruns. Like this is actually 2 J-Days ago, and what just happened never happened.
Okay, says Fred. What's on Outercom? You want to watch soap operas? Dubonnet fumes. Sure, why not?
We're looking at the menu when something new appears. It's called the Soledad E. Gottmansdatter Farewell Special. The name has me thinking we're about to see Fry in her old two-stepper incarnation. But what comes up on the screen is a chambered nautilus.
Hi, everybody. How do you like the new me? Fry says.
What, is she going to law school?
Aunt Chovy says, shocked.
I'm sorry to leave you a canned goodbye, because you've all been so great.
Fry goes on. And I have to knot my arms together to keep from turning the thing off. This doesn't sound like it's gonna end well.
I knew even before I came out here that I'd be going out for sushi. I just couldn't decide what kind. You guys had me thinking seriously about Octo. It's a pretty great life, and everything you do matters. Future generations, well, it's going to be amazing out here. Life that adapted to space. Who knows? Maybe someday Jovian citizens will change bodies like two-steppers change their clothes. It could happen. But like a lot of two-steppers, I'm impatient. I know I'm not a two-stepper anymore, and I've got a far longer lifespan now, so I don't have to be impatient. But I am. I wanted to be part of something that's taking the next step. The next big step, right now. I really believe the Jupiter colony is what I've been looking for.
The Jupiter colony? They're cranks. They're suicidal.
Glennis hits the ceiling, banks off a wall, and comes down again. Fry unfurls her tentacles and lets them wave around freely.
Calm down whoever's yelling, she says, sounding amused. I made contact with them just before I crewed up with you. I knew what they were planning. They wouldn't tell me when, but it wasn't hard to figure out the OKK Hightower impact was the perfect opportunity. We've collected some jellies, muted them, and put in yak-yak loops. I don't know how the next part works, how we're going to hitch a ride with the comet. I'm not an astrophysicist. But if it works, we'll seed the clouds with ourselves. We're all chambered nautiluses on this trip. It's the best form for packing a lot of data. But we've made one small change. We're linked together, shell to shell, so we all have access to each other's data. Not too private, but we aren't going into exile as separate hermits. There should still be some sensors bobbing around in the upper levels. The colonies had allies tossing various things in on the sly. We can use whatever's there to build a cloudborne colony. We don't know for sure it'll work. Maybe we'll all get gravitated to smithereens.
But if we can fly long enough for the jellies to convert to paracels, the engineers figure that out, don't ask me. We might figure out not only how to survive, but thrive. Unfortunately, I won't be able to let you know, not until we get around the interference problem. I don't know much about that either, but if I last long enough, I'll learn. Dove says right now you're all down under on loan to Outercom. I'm going to send this message so it bounces around the ice giants for a while before it gets to you, and with any luck, you'll find it not too long after we enter the atmosphere. I hope none of you are too mad at me, or at least that you don't stay mad at me. It's not entirely impossible that we'll meet again someday. If we do, I'd like it to be as friends. Especially if the Jovian independence movement gets, she laughs. I was about to say, gets off the ground. If the Jovian independence movement ever achieves a stable orbit or something, I think it's a really good idea. Anyway, goodbye for now. Oh, an RK? Her tentacles undulate wildly. I had no idea Wormy would feel so good. We just got that one play before the JCC blacked it out. The feds took us all in for questioning. Not surprising. But it wasn't just Big J feds. Dirt feds suddenly popped up out of nowhere. Some of them in person, and some of them long distance via comm units clamped to Mobies. The latter is a big waste unless there's some benefit to having a conversation as slowly as possible. Because even a fed on Mars can't do anything about the speed of light. It's still gonna be at least an hour between the question and the answer, usually more. The dirt feds who were actually here were all working undercover, keeping an eye on things, and reporting whatever they heard or saw to HQ back in the dirt. This didn't go down so well with most of us out here, even two-steppers. It became a real governmental crisis, mainly because no one in charge could get their stories straight. Some were denying any knowledge of dirt spies. Some were trying to spin it, so it was all for our benefit, so we wouldn't lose any rights. Don't ask me which ones, they didn't say. Conspiracy theories blossomed faster than anyone could keep track. Finally, the ruling council resigned. The acting council replacing them till the next election are almost all sushi. That's a first. It's still another deck and a half till the election. Jove Op usually backs two-steppers, but there are noticeably few political ads for bipeds this time around. I think even they can see the points on the trajectory. A lot of sushi are already celebrating, talking about the changing face of government in the Jovian system. I'm not quite ready to party. I'm actually a little bit worried about us. We were born to be sushi, but we weren't born sushi. We all started out as two-steppers, and while we may have shed binary thinking, that doesn't mean we're completely enlightened. There's already some talk about how most of the candidates are chambered nautiluses, and there ought to be more octos or puffers or crabs. I don't like the sound of that, but it's too late to make a break for the colony now. Not that I would. Even if Fry and all her fellow colonists are surviving and thriving, I'm not ready to give up the life I have for a whole new world. We'll just have to see what happens. Hey, I told you not to get me started on politics.
The Deeps of the Sky, Elizabeth Baer. Storm Chase's little skiff skipped and glided across the tropopause, skimming the denser atmosphere of the warm cloud sea beneath, running before a fierce wind. The skiff's hull was broad and shallow, supported by buoyant pontoons, the whole designed to float atop the heavy, opaque atmosphere beneath. Storm chases had shot the sails high into the stratosphere, and good winds blew the skiff onward against the current of the dark belt beneath. Ahead, the vast ruddy wall of a deep storm loomed, the base wreathed in shreds of tossing white mist. Caustic water clouds churned up from deep in the deadly layered troposphere. The deep storm stretched from horizon to horizon, disappearing at either end in a blur of perspective and atmospheric haze. Its breadth was so great as to make even its massive height seem insignificant, though the billowing ammonia cloud wall was smeared flat-topped by stratospheric wind where it broke the tropopause. The storm glowed with the heat of the deep atmosphere, other skiffs silhouetted cool against it. Their chatter rang over Storm Chase's talker. Briefly, he leaned down to the pickup and greeted his colleagues, his competition. Many of them came from the same long lines of miners that he did. Many carried the same long-hoarded knowledge. But Storm Chase's was determined that, with the addition of his own skill and practice, he would be among the best sky miners of them all. Behind and above, clear sky showed a swallowing indigo speckled with bright stars. The hurtling crescents of a dozen or so of the moons were currently visible, as was the searing pinpoint of the world's primary, so bright it washed out nearby stars. Warmth made the sky glow too, the variegated brightness of the thermosphere far above. Storm Chase's thorax squeezed with emotion as he gazed upon the elegant canopies of a group of drift worlds rising in slow sunlit coils along the warm vanguard of the deep storm, their colors bright by sunlight, their silhouettes dark by thermal sense. He should not look, he should not hope. But there, a distant hazed shape behind her lesser daughters and sisters, her great canopy dappled in sheeny gold and violet, soared the mother graves. Storm Chase's was too far and low to see the teeming ecosystem she bore on her vast back, up high above the colorful clouds where the sunlight could reach and nurture them. He could just make out the color variations caused by the dripping net roots of veil trees that draped the mother grave's sides, capturing life-giving ammonia from the atmosphere and drawing it in to plump leaves and firm, nutritious fruit. Storm Chases arched his face up to her, eyes shivering with longing. His wings hummed against his back. There was no desire like the pain of being separated from the mother graves, no need like the need to go to her. But he must resist it. He must brave the deep storm and harvest it, and perhaps then she would deem him worthy to be one of hers. He had the provider status to pay court to one of the younger drift worlds, but they could not give his young the safety and stability that a birth on the greatest and oldest of the mothers would. In the hot deeps of the sky, too high even for the mothers and their symbiotic colony flyers, or too low even for the boldest and most intrepid of Storm Chase's brethren, other things lived. Above were other kinds of flyers and the drifters, winged or buoyant or merely infinitesimal things that could not survive even the moderate pressure and chill of the tropopause. Below, swimmers dwelled in the ammoniated thicks of the mid-tropopause that never knew the light of stars or sun. They saw only thermally. They could endure massive pressures, searing temperatures, and the lashings of molten water and even oxygen, the gas so reactive that it could set an exhalation on fire. That environment would crush Storm Chase's to a pulp, dissolve his delicate wing membranes, burn him from the gills to the bone. Storm Chase's folk were built for more moderate climes. The clear skies and thick buoying atmosphere of the tropopause, where life flourished and the skies were full of food. But even here, in this temperate part of the sky, survival required a certain element of risk. And there were things that could only be mined where a deep storm pulled them up through the layers of atmosphere to an accessible height. Which was why Storm Chases sailed directly into the lowering wings of the deep storm, one manipulator on the skiff's controls, the other watching the perspective-shrunken sail shimmering so high above. Flyers would avoid the cable, which was monofilament spun into an intentionally refractive, high-visibility lattice with good tensile properties. But the enormous translucent-bodied drift worlds were not nimble. Chances were good that the mother would survive a sail impact, albeit with some scars, and some damage to the Sky Island ecosystem she carried on her backs, and the skiff would likely hold together through such an incident. If he tangled a mother in the monofilament shroud line spun from the same material that reinforced the drift world's great canopies, it didn't bear thinking of. That was why the lines were so gaily streamered, so anyone could see them from afar. If storm chases lost the skiff, it would just be a long flight home and probably a period of indenture to another miner until he could earn another and begin proving himself again. But injuring a mother, even a minor one who floated low, would be the end of his hopes to serve the Mother Graves. So he watched the cable and the overhead skies, and of course, the storm. Storm chasers could smell the deep storm now, the dank corrosive tang of water vapor stinging his gills. The richly colored billows of the deep storm proved it had something to give. The storm's dark red wall churned, marking the boundary of a nearly closed atmospheric cell rich with rare elements and compounds pumped up from the deeps. Soon, Storm Chases would don his protective suit, seal the skiff, and begin the touchy business, so close to the storm, of hauling in the sail. The prevailing wind broke around the deep storm, eddying and compacting as it sped past those towering clouds. The air currents there were even more dangerous and unnavigable than those at the boundary between the world's temperate and subtropical zones, where two counter-rotating bands of wind met and sheared against each other. And Storm Chases was going to pass through it. Once the sail was stowed, Storm Chases would maneuver the skiff closer under engine power, as close as those cool silhouettes ahead, and begin harvesting. But he would not be cowed by the storm wall, could not be if he hoped to win a berth on the Mother Graves. He would brave the outer walls of the storm itself. He had the skill. He had the ancestral knowledge. The reward for his courage would be phosphates, silicates, organic compounds, iron, solid things from which technologies like his skiff were built, noble gases, and fallers, the tiny creatures that spent their small lives churned in the turbulence of the deep storm, and which were loaded with valuable nutrition and trace elements hard to obtain for the unfledged juveniles who lived amid the roots and foliage and trapped organics of the drift world ecosystems. The deep storm was a rich, if deadly, resource. With its treasures, he would purchase his place on the Mother Graves. Storm Chases streamed current weather data, forecasts, and predictions. He tuned into the pulse-light broadcasts of the skiffs already engaged in harvesting and set about making himself ready. The good news about deep storms was that they were extraordinarily stable, and the new information didn't tell Storm Chases much that he could not have anticipated. Still, there was always a thrill of unease as one made ready for a filtering run. A little too far and, well, everyone knew or knew of somebody who had been careless at the margin of a storm and sucked into the depths of its embrace. A skiff couldn't survive that, and a person definitely couldn't. If the molten water didn't cauterize flesh from carapace, convective torrents would soon drag one down into the red depths of the atmosphere to be melted and crushed and torn. It was impossible to be too careful sky mining. Storm Chases checked the skiff's edge seals preliminary to locking down. Water could insinuate through a tiny gap and spray under the pressure of winds, costing an unwary or unlucky operator an eye. Too many sky miners bore the scars of its caustic burns on their carapaces and manipulators. A careful assessment showed the seals to be intact. Behind the skiff, the long cluster of carbo capsules bumped and swung. Empty, they were buoyant and tended to drag the skiff upwards, forcing Storm Chases to constant adjustments of the trim. He dropped a sky anchor and owner beacon to hold the majority of the cargo capsules, loaded one into the skiff's dock with the magnetic claw, and turned the little vessel toward the storm. Siphons contracted, feeling each heave of the atmosphere, storm chases slid quickly but cautiously into the turbulent band surrounding the storm. It would be safer to match the wind's velocity before he made the transition to within the storm itself, but his little skiff did not have that much power. Instead, it was built to catch the wind and self-orient, using the storm itself for stability rather than being tumbled and tossed like a thrown flyer's egg. Storm chases fixed his restraint harness to the tightest setting. He brought the skiff alongside the cloud wall, then deflated and retracted the pontoons, leaving the skiff less buoyant but far more streamlined. Holding hope in his mind, hope because the Mother Graves taught that intention affected outcome, Storm Chases took a deep breath, smelled the tang of methane on his exhalation, and slipped the skiff into the storm. The wind hit the skiff in a torrent. Through long experience, Storm Chases' manipulators stayed soft on the controls. He let them vibrate against his skin, but held them steady, gently, gently, without too much pressure, but without yielding to the wrath of the storm. The skiff tumbled for a moment as it made the transition. He regained trim and steadied it, bringing its pointed nose around to part the wind that pushed it. It shivered, feeling alive as the sun-warmed hide of the mother upon whose broad back Storm Chases had grown and steadied. Storm Chases guided it with heat sight only. Here in the massive swirl of the cloud wall, the viewports showed him only the skiff's interior lighting reflecting off the featureless red clouds of the storm, as if he and his rugged little ship were swaddled in an uncle's wings. A peaceful image for a thing that would kill him in instants. If he went too far in, the winds would rip his tiny craft apart around him. If he got too close to the wall, turbulence would send him spinning out of control. When the skiff finally floated serenely amidst the unending gyre, Storm Chases opened the siphons. He felt the skiff belly and wallow as the wind filled it, then the increased stability as the filters activated and the capsule filled. It didn't take long. The storm was pumping a rich mix of resources. When the capsule reached its pressurized capacity, Storm Chases sealed the siphons again. Still holding his position against the fury of the winds, he tested the responses of the laden skiff. It was heavier, sluggish, but as responsive as he could have hoped. He brought her out of the fog of red and gray under a clear black sky. A bit of turbulence caught his wingtip as he slipped away, and it sent the skiff spinning flat like a spat seed across the tropopause. Other skiffs scattered like a swarm of infant cloud skaters before a flyer's dive. Shaken, the harness bruising his soft flesh at his joints, Storm Chases got control of the skiff and brought her around on a soft loop. His talker exploded with the whoops of other miners, mingled appreciation and teasing. There was his beacon. He deployed pontoons to save energy and skimmed the atmosphere over to exchange capsules. Then he turned to the storm and went back to do it again. Storm Chases had secured his full capsules and was still rechecking the skiff's edge seals, preliminary to popping the craft open, when he caught sight of a tiny speck of a shadow descending along the margin of the storm. Something sharp-nosed and hot enough to be uncomfortable to look upon. Storm Chases scrambled for the telescope as the speck dropped toward the deep storm. It locked and tracked. He pressed two eyes to the viewers and found himself regarding a sleek black something, a glossy surface he could not name, nor could he make out any detail of shape. The autofocus had locked too close, and as he backed it off, the object slipped into the edge of the deep storm. Bigger than a flyer, bigger even than folk, and nothing with any sense would get that close to the smeary pall of water vapor without protective gear. It looked a little like a flyer, though, a curved, streamlined wing shaped with a dart-like nose. But the wings didn't flap as it descended, banking wide on the cushion of air before the storm, curving between the scudding masses of the herd of drift worlds. It was like nothing storm chasers had ever seen. Its belly was bright hot, hot enough to spark open flame if it brushed oxygen, but as it banked, storm chasers saw that the back was cold, black cold against the warmth of the high sky, so dark and chill it seemed a band of brightness delineated it. But that was only the contrast with the soaking heat from the thermosphere. Storm chasers had always had an interest in xenophysics. He felt his wings furl with shock as he realized that the object might show that heat pattern if it had warmed its belly with friction as it entered the atmosphere, but the upper part were still breath-stealing cold with the chill of the deep sky. Was it a ship and not an animal? A skiff of some kind? An alien? Lightning danced around the object, caught and caressed it like a mother's feeding tendrils caging a mate, and then seemed to get caught there, netting and streaking the black hide with rills of savage glowing vermilion and radiant gold. The wind of the object's passage blew the shimmers off the trailing edge of its wings. Shining vapor writhed in curls in the turbulence of its wake. Storm chases caught his breath. Neon and helium rain, condensing upon the object's hard skin, energized by the lightning, luminesced as the object skimmed the high windswept edge of the clouds. With the eyes not pressed to the telescope, he watched a luminescent red-gold line draw across the dull red roiling storm wall. Below, at the tropopause border of the storm, the other filter miners were pulling back, grouping together and gliding away. They had noticed the phenomenon, and the smart sky miner didn't approach a storm that was doing something he didn't understand. Lightning was a constant wreath in the storm's upper regions, and whatever the object or creature was made of, the storm seemed to want to reach out and caress it. Meanwhile, the object played with the walls of the storm, threading it like a needle, as oblivious to those deadly veils of water vapor as it was to the savagery of the lightning strikes. Storm chases had operated a mining skiff, valued work, prestigious work, work he hoped would earn him a place in the Mother Grave's esteem for his entire fledged life. He'd seen skiffs go down, seen daring rescues, seen miners saved from impossible situations and miners who were not. He'd seen recklessness, and skills so great its exercise looked like recklessness. He'd never seen anyone play with a deep storm like this. It couldn't last. It could have been a crosswind, an eddy, the shear of turbulence. Storm chases would never know. But one moment the black object, streaming its meteor tail of noble gases, was stitching the flank of the storm, and the next it was tumbling, knocked end over end like the losing flyer of a mating dogfight. Storm chases pulled back from the telescope, watching as the object rolled in a flat descending spiral like a coiled tree frond pulled long. The object was built like a flyer. It had no pontoons, no broad hull meant to maximize its buoyancy against the pressure gradient of the tropopause. It would fall through and keep falling. Storm chases clenched the gunwale of his skiff in tense manipulators, glad when the alien object fell well inside the boundary of the storm-fronting thermal the drift worlds rode. It seemed so wrong. The mothers floating lazily with their multicolored sides placid in the sun, the object plunging to destruction amid the hells of the deep sky, trailing streamers of neon light. It was folly to project his own experiences upon something that was not folk, of course, but he couldn't help it. If the object was a skiff, if the aliens were like folk, he knew they would be at their controls even now. Storm chases felt a great searing pity. They were something new, and he didn't want them to die. Did they need to? They had a long way to fall, and they were fighting it. The telescope, still locked on the alien object, glided smoothly in its mount. It would be easy to compute the falling ship's trajectory. Other skiffs were doing so in order to clear the crash path. Storm chases. Storm Chases pulled up the navigation console, downloaded other skiffs' telemetry on and calculations of the trajectory of the falling craft, ran his own. The object was slowing, but it was not slowing enough, and he was close enough to the crash path to intercept. He thought of the Mother Graves. He thought of his rich cargo, the price of acceptance. He clenched his gills and fired his engines to cross the path of the crash. Its flat spiral path aided him. He did not need to intercept on this pass, though there would not be too many more opportunities. It was a fortunate thing that the object had a long way to fall. All he had to do was get under it, in front of it, and let the computer and the telescope and the cannon do the rest. There. Now. Even as he thought it, the skiff's machines made their own decision. The sail cannon boomed. The first sail itself was a bright streamer climbing the stratosphere. Storm Chases checked his restraints with his manipulators in one eye, aware that he'd left it too late. The other three eyes stayed on the alien object and the ballistic arc of the rising sail. It snapped to the end of its line, low, too low, so much lower than such things should be deployed. It seemed enormous as it spread. It was enormous, but Storm Chases was not used to seeing a sail so close. He braced himself, one manipulator hovering over the control to depressurize the cargo capsules strung behind him in a long jostling tail. The object fell into the sail. Storm Chases had a long moment to watch the bright sail, dappled in vermilion and violet, stretch into a trailing comet tail as it caught and wrapped the projectile. He watched the streamers of the shroud lines buck at impact, the wave traveling their length. The stretch and yank snapped Storm Chases back against his restraints. He felt the shiver through the frame of the skiff as the shroud motors released, letting the falling object haul line as if it were a flyer running away with the bait. The object's spiraling descent became an elongating pendulum arc, and Storm Chases hoped it or they had the sense not to struggle. The shroud lines and the sails stretched, twanged, held. The Mother Graves wove the sails from her own silk. They were the same stuff as her canopies. There was no stronger fiber. Then the object swung down into the tropopause and splashed through the sea of ammonia clouds and kept falling. The sealed skiff jerked after. Storm Chases felt the heavy crack through the hull as the pontoons broke. He lost light sight of the sky above as the clouds closed over. He felt as if he floated against his restraints, though he knew it was just the acceleration of the fall defying gravity. He struggled to bring his manipulator down. The deeper the object pulled him, the hotter and more pressurized and more toxic the atmosphere became, and he wouldn't trust the skiff seals after the jar of that impact. He depressurized and helium flushed the first cargo capsule. When it blew, the skiff shuddered again. That capsule was now a balloon filled with gaseous helium, and it snapped upward, slowing Storm Chase's descent. And the descent of the sail-wrapped alien object. They were still plunging, but now dragging a buoyant makeshift pontoon. The cables connecting the capsule twanged and plinked ominously. It had been the flaw in his plan. He hadn't been sure that they would hold. For now, at least, they did. The pressure outside the hull was growing, not dangerous yet, but creeping upward. Eyes on the display, Storm Chases triggered a second capsule. He felt a lighter shudder this time as the skiff shed a little more velocity. The next question would be if he had enough capsules to stop the fall, and to lift his skiff and the netted object back to the tropopause. His talker babbled at him, his colleagues issuing warnings and organizing a party for a rescue to follow his descent. "No rescue," he said. "This is my risk." Another capsule, another slider shiver through the lines, another incremental slowing. "By the Mother Graves," he thought, "this is actually going to work." When his skiff bobbed back to the tropopause dangling helplessly beneath a dozen empty pressurized capsules, Storm Chases was unprepared for the cheer that rang over his talker, or the bigger one that followed when he winched the sail containing the netted object up through the cloud sea into clear air. Storm Chases had no pontoons. His main sail was fouled. The empty capsules would support him, but he could not maneuver, and in fact his skiff swung beneath them, hull to the side, needle-tip nose pointing down. Storm Chases dangled, bruised and aching in his restraints, trying to figure out how to loose the straps and start work on freeing himself. He still wasn't sure how he'd survived, or that he'd survived. Maybe this was the last fantasy of a dying mind. The talker bleated at him. He jerked against the harness and moaned. The talker bleated again. It wasn't words, and whatever it was, it drowned out the voices of the other miners, who were currently arguing over whether his skiff was salvage and whether they should come to his assistance if it was. He'd been trying to organize his addled thoughts enough to warn them off. Now he vibrated his membranes and began to croak a sound fragile even to his own hearing. Who is it? What do you want? That bleat again, or a modestly different one. Are you the alien? I can't understand you. With pained manipulators, Storm Chases managed to unfasten his restraints. He dropped from them harder than he had intended. It seemed he couldn't hold on to the rack. As his carapace struck the forward bulkhead, he made a disgruntled noise. Speak language, he snarled to the talker as he picked himself up. I can't understand you. It was mostly an expression of frustration. If they knew language, they wouldn't be aliens. But he could not hide his sigh of relief when a deep, coveted voice emerged from the talker instead. Be strong, Storm Chases, the Mother Grave said. All will soon be well. He pressed two eyes to the viewport. The clouds around his skiff were bright in the sunlight. He watched the encroaching shadow fall across them like the umbra of an eclipse. It was the great welcome shade of the Mother Graves as she drifted out of the sky. She was coming for them. Coming for him. It was no small thing for a drift world to drop so much altitude. For a drift world the size of the Mother Graves, it was a major undertaking, and not one speedily accomplished. Still, she dropped, flanked by her attendant squadrons of flyers and younger mothers, tiny shapes flitting between her backs. Many of them could have come for Storm Chases more easily, but when they would have moved forward, the Mother Graves gestured them back with her trailing, elegant gestures. Storm Chases occupied the time winching in the sail net containing the alien object. It was heavy, not buoyant at all. He imagined it must skim through the surface like a dart or a flyer, simply by moving so fast that the aerodynamics of its passage bore it up. He would have liked to disentangle the object from the shroud, but if he did, it would sink like a punctured skiff. Instead, he amused himself by assessing the damage to his skiff, catastrophic, and answering the alien's bleats on the talker somewhat at random, though he had not given up on trying to understand what it might be saying. Obviously, it had technology. Quite possibly it was technology, and the hard carapace might indeed be the equivalent of his own skiff, a craft meant for entering a hostile environment. Had it been sampling the storm for useful chemicals and consumables as well? He wondered what aliens ate, what they breathed. He wondered if he could teach them language. Every time he looked up, the Mother Grave's great keel was lower. Finally, her tendrils encompassed his horizons, and when he craned his eyes back, he could make out the double row of mates fused to and dependent from her bellies like so many additional vestigial tendrils. There were dozens. The oldest had lost all trace of their origins and were merely smooth nubs sealed to the Mother Grave's flesh. The newest were still identifiable as the individuals they had been. Many of the lesser mothers among her escort dangled mates from their bellies as well, but none had half so many as the mother graves, and none were so much as 2/3 of her size. In frustration, Storm Chases squinched himself against the interior of his carapace. So close. He had been so close. And now all he had to show for it was a wrecked skiff and a bleeding alien. Now he would have to start over. He could ask the Mother Graves to release his groom price to a lesser mother. He had provided well enough for any of her sisters or daughters to consider him. But none of them were she. He only hoped his sacrifice of resources in order to rescue the alien had not angered her. That would be too much to bear, although if she decided to reclaim the loss from his corpse, he supposed at the very least he would die fulfilled, if briefly. The talker squawked again. The alien sounds seemed more familiar. He must be getting used to them. A few of the Mother Grave's tendrils touched him as he had so long anticipated. It was bitterest irony now, but the pleasures of the caress almost made it worthwhile. He braced himself for pain and paralysis, but she withheld her sting, and the only pain were the bruises left by his restraints and by impact with the bulkheads of the tumbling skiff. Now her voice came to him directly rather than by way of the talker. It filled the air around him and vibrated in the hollows of his body like soft thunder. To his shock and disbelief, she said words of ritual to him, words he had hoped and then despaired to hear. She said, "For the wealth of the whole, what have you brought us, Storm Chases?" Before he could answer, the talker bleated again, this time in something like language. Bent, barely comprehensible, accented more oddly than any language Storm Chases had ever heard. It said, "Hello? You us comprehend?" "I hear you," the Mother Grave said. "What do you want?" A long silence before the answer came. "This we fix. Trade science. Go. Place you give us for repairs." The aliens, the object was a skiff of sorts, and it had as many crew members as Storm Chases had eyes, had a machine that translated their bleedy words into language, given a wise enough sample of it. As the revolutions went by, the machine became more and more proficient, and Storm Chases spent more and more time talking to Alice, their crew member in charge of talking. Their names were just nonsense sounds, not words, which made him wonder how any of them ever knew who he was. And they divided labor up in strange ways, with roles determined not by instar and inheritance, but by individual life courses. They told him a great deal about themselves and their peculiar biology. He reciprocated with the more mundane details of his own. Ali seemed particularly interested that he would soon mate and wished to know as much about the process as he could tell. The aliens sealed themselves in small flexible habitats, pressure carapaces to leave their skiff, and for good reason. They were made mostly of water, and they oozed water from their bodies, and the pressure and temperature of the world's atmosphere would destroy them as surely as the deeps of the sky would crush Storm Chases. The atmosphere they breathed was made of inert gases and explosive oxygen, and once their skiff was breached on an open patch of the Mother Grave's back for repairs, just the leakage of oxygen and water vapor from its airlock soon poisoned a swath of vegetation for a body length in any direction. Storm Chases stayed well back from the alien skiff while he had these conversations. Talking to the alien was a joy and a burden. The Mother Graves insisted he should be the one to serve as an intermediary. He had experience with them, and the aliens valued that kind of experience. And when he was mated, that experience would be assimilated into the Mother Graves' collective mind. It would become a part of her and a part of all their progeny to follow. The Mother Graves had told him, in the ritual words, that knowledge and discovery were great offerings, unique offerings. That the opportunity to interact with beings from another world was of greater import to her and her brood than organics or metals or substances that she could machine within her great body into the stuff of skiffs and sails and other technology. That she accepted his suit and honored the courage with which he had pressed it. And that was why the duty was a burden. Because to be available for the aliens while they made the repairs, to play liaison, their word, meant putting off the moment of joyous union again and again. To have been so close and then so far and then so close again. The agony of anticipation and the fear that it would be snatched from him again was a form of torture. Alice came outside of the alien skiff in her pressure carapace and sat in its water-poisoned circle with her forelimbs wrapped around her drawn-up knees, talking comfortably to storm chases. She said she was a female, a mother, but that mothers of her kind were not so physically different from the males, and that even after they mated, males continued to go about in the world as independent entities. But how do they pass their experiences on to their offspring, Storm Chases asked. Alice paused for a long time. We teach them, she said. Your children inherit your memories. Not memories, he said. Experiences. She hesitated again. So you become part of the mother, a kind of symbiote. And your offspring with her will have all of her experiences and yours, but not the memories. How does that work? Is knowledge a memory? He asked. No, she said confidently. Memories can be destroyed while skills remain. Oh, I think I understand. They talked for a little while of the structure of the nets and the mother's canopies, but Storm Chases could tell Alice was not finished thinking about memories. Finally, she made a little deflating hiss sound and brought the subject up again. I am sad, Alice said, that when we have fixed our sampler and had time to arrange a new mission and come back, you will not be here to talk with us. I will be here, said Storm Chases, puzzled. I will be mated to the Mother Graves. But it won't be... Whatever Alice had been about to say, the translator stammered on it. She continued, The same. You won't remember us. The Mother Graves will, Storm Chases assured her. She drew herself in a little smaller. It will be a long time before we return. Storm Chases padded toward the edge of the burn zone. He did not let his manipulators cross it, though. Though he would soon enough lose the use of his manipulators to atrophy, he didn't feel the need to burn them off prematurely. It's all right, Alice, he said. We will remember you by the scar. Whatever the sound she made next, the translator could not manage it.